And what will be the sign of the end of the age? Last week we read verses 9 through 22 and looked at their meaning. And you take a minute to talk about the character of God just a little bit, to think about how does God relate to people? What does it look like when he relates to him, people? And it's so varied in the Old Testament. I don't know if you've studied a lot about the things he does and doesn't do, the things he says and doesn't say. But God does not reveal himself fully to man. Because that if we looked on God fully, we would die, right? So we have a limited ability to understand him. We see in lots of Bible stories, Jonah, Noah, David, all these Bible characters, Jeremiah, Isaiah, all these people, God revealed himself to a limited extent. At other times, God can be very specific. When God appeared to Jonah or gave Jonah direction, he was very specific in what he had to say. He didn't go say, find a town that needs ministered to, use your best judgment and go there. He said, go to Nineveh. And so God can be very specific. He can also give us challenges that are quite general. When he says, marked by God are those who hunger and thirst, that kind of applies to a lot of people across the board. If you hunger and thirst for God, you will be satisfied. As we look at God, we realize that God does what he needs to do, bringing enough of his personality and strength into the equation to move it in the way that he wants to move it. I wrote it this way, the people that need to know, know. God communicates enough to get you to know what he wants you to know. So our conclusions about God, first of all, are that God is big. He is not a little God. I might have shared before, at Solid Rock, we get tracks donated to us. And we had this whole box of tracks, and it was little potato characters. I'm not really, you know, it was pretty good overall. But then it got to the point where it equated God with like a weapon, a gun. And it said, well, God is the powder, but we are the trigger. What do you think of that? No, we don't, you know, God's a little bigger than that, right? God just can't do anything unless we let him, you know, or unless we initiate him. So God is big. He's all powerful, all knowing, all present everywhere. When Jesus is sharing these verses about God and what is coming, the disciples have a pretty clear idea of what he's saying. He's been preparing them for these statements for nearly 3 years. The prophecies make good sense to them, but they are a challenge to us. Now, the next little concept I'm going to drop on you is going to probably sail right on by. So you can start daydreaming right now if you want. That's okay. When we think of prophecy in our Western culture, we think of, you know, on Thursday at 2:00, this is going to happen. And so we're very specific about our culture, our prophecy as we look at them. But the Jewish people, their prophecies are often viewed by them as a cyclical nature, meaning it could speak to the issue of now, recently, or indicate a later prophecy as well. That prophecy may come many times over and over and over. And you can see this in some of the stories in the Old Testament. We will use one for an example. The dispor, which means the dispersing of the children of Israel at the Babylonian captivity, was prophesied. Well, it's not the only dispersion that's going to happen to them. And the same prophecy can apply to both of them. The fact that they came back to the land at the time of Zerubbabel and all those guys, they thought that would be forever. But we know that when Rome came in and waited in there, they dispersed them again. So you have a cyclical nature of some of these prophecies. So these are repeated over and over. The Romans will destroy Jerusalem and the temple, and then these things will happen again. The dispersion, then the returning to the land. And that is what we mean by cyclical prophecies. We struggle to find anchor points in which to base our understanding because our culture isn't the same as their culture. excuse me, cyclical prophecy helped them to see the truth in the things to come and the things that are now, the end of the age, which would be the sign of his coming. So let's go to verse 23 and pick that back up, verse 23 and 25. And then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So he's telling them at the end of the time that all of these false prophets will come. And we know that they are coming now. They're claiming it. They've claimed it ever since Jesus left. Fortunately, I don't have a television, so I don't have to watch evangelistic TV, which I don't know if any of you watch much of that. But some of those guys are pretty hard to take in terms of their claims and what they say they believe. He says, even if they should show great signs, do not believe it. Do not be drawn into that. And he says there, I have told you beforehand. So you have that warning. And then in verse 26 and 28, he says, therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he is in the inner room, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes in the east, from the east and flashes to the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. For wherever the carcass is, there will eagles be gathered also. So he's saying, do not be drawn into catchy phrases, religious jargon, not even religious nationalism, which can draw us astray from the task that we have as following Jesus closely. Nothing wrong with being patriotic, right? But when you see, like, the Civil War, each side killing each other, claiming that God would want that, we know that probably something is askew there. So all of our efforts should be modified by an intense love of God, an intense following of what He would want, not the things that people urge us to do. He is in the desert, do not go out. Do not believe it. We have to be discerning toward these things. Now, if you look here, it's an interesting verse shows up in verse 27, an interesting phrase. The phrase, the Son of Man, shows up. Do you see that there? That's something that we haven't seen for a while in here. And all of a sudden, it's going to show up 6 times in the next 17 verses. If you glance down through there, you just keep seeing the Son of Man will appear, the Son of Man will appear, the Son of Man. And he just keeps showing up, and you ask, why does that show up so many times when earlier he was referring to himself or the Christ, I am the Christ. He doesn't refer to it as the Son of Man. So we see a shift here from more present details of his coming to longer out there future details. Let's look at the phrase the Son of Man just for a minute so that you can maybe have a grip to understand that. If you remember, do you remember when Peter tried to walk on water? Do you guys remember this? The storm. And after he calmed the water, do you remember what Peter's response was? Surely this is the Son of God. He didn't say the Son of Man. See, so what they were looking at then, they were looking at a man who looked like a man, but could do the things that God could do. Which is a totally radically different thing than what they were used to seeing. Well, how is this phrase different now? When he's talking about the end times, he's talking about the Son of Man. Let's read the next phrase and then I'll refer to the next paragraph and then I'll refer to it a little bit more. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear and then all the tribes on earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. And they will gather together his elect from four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. See, the Son of Man there, when he comes back, he's going to come back with authority as God. But he's going to have physical attributes that you recognize him as a person, a Son of Man. So in this sense, he's going to present himself different. You see, when Jesus was on earth, and this time, and for the next couple chapters, you see that Jesus is being very humble. He's being led by them. He's going to be crucified by them. And we know good and well, if he's all the things we just said he was, omniscient and all powerful, he could certainly just thrash them all. But he chose not to. He had a specific agenda that he was working toward, and that's what he worked toward. And he didn't get sidetracked on peripheral agendas, which religious people are always getting sidetracked on, except for you guys, of course. So have the idea in there that when the Son of Man will appear from heaven, it will be a recognizable physical entity with exercising the power of God, instead of a more man doing some special things when they referred to him as the Son of God. It's interesting that it says the tribes of the earth will mourn. So he's not going to be any more welcome next time he comes. And this isn't talking about the rapture here. We're talking about the end of the age. We're talking about when he comes back to set up and rule. They aren't going to be welcoming anymore because, see, all along right now, if you walk out of here today and you go choose to do something wrong, it's not the will of God that you would do that, but he allows you to do that. That's his permissive will. He allows you to do those ridiculous, silly things that will be destructive to you. He allows you to run through the red light on the semaphore and destroy yourself and others, because this is our time for that. But eventually the time will come when God appears in power through Jesus Christ that there won't be options. He will have it his way. And it will be a righteous way, a good way. But if you hate him, it certainly won't be a good way. That's why we have this time in life to try to bring ourselves around to the point where we recognize and appreciate who he is. So they're not going to look forward to them. And then we have in verse 32, and we'll look at this little story. Mel and I like this one because it. She taught this at a Bible study, so I got it from her. The illustration, that is. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When the branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that the summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will be in no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words by no means will pass away. Alaskans should know, we should be able to identify with this paragraph. After a long, cold winter, do any of you take pleasure in seeing the little leaves starting to bud out on the tree? And that, you know, usually it's like along the south side of the house, one blade of grass pops up, you know, it is this long. And of course, then the dandelions within 3 seconds of the snow melting, there in full bloom, claiming their first place to spring. See, it's that anticipation. I have a daughter who has a birthday. Oh, speaking of, I have to, may I digress? I have a new granddaughter, born this week, so I'm very happy for that. That's 13. So, what? Anyway. Yes, Lucy is her name, and she's very healthy and very cute, and born to Noah and Courtney, who attend here usually and sit in the bleachers, but aren't here today. So, they do the barn work. He's the guy that spoke when I was gone once, when Bob left the barn. He handed over the reins. Never mind. To Noah, and so he carries that on. But anyway, so. I don't know how that came to mind right there, but I just had to share it with you. So, yeah, that's something like that. Thank you. That made me seem intelligent. I appreciate it. And see, we respond to spring because of the drastic nature of our winters, but they responded to spring because, and they understood spring because if spring didn't come, they weren't going to make it. They didn't have their fruit shipped in from Florida and California and every place. I mean, you had to have spring. If spring didn't come, you were dead. So it is with the kind of anticipation the clear sign that we know spring is coming by these little signs that he tells us to look forward to what is coming. It is interesting to note here when he says that this generation will by no means pass away until all these things take place. Tony will meet with you in the back to discuss the exact meaning of this after the service. It is an interesting concept. It's much discussed. The term generation there could be interpreted race or nation. Many other words as well, not just that one. So that's one for discussion, what that word exactly means there. But certainly we know the nation or the race will not pass away till those things take place. And then we come to an interesting verse that is in verse 36 and 37. I'm going to read that whole paragraph and then we'll draw it to a close. But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at that hour that you do not expect. Larry Norman, anybody know who Larry Norman is? John, there's John. He wrote a song, right? And it's sung at camps forever. But it's kind of inverse of the actual meaning here. This is not the rapture. So the one taken is not the righteous one. The one left is the righteous one. And the one taken is the one that's going to go into judgment. So of the two men in the field, the one left is the one that will continue to rule with God. And the one that's taken will be brought to judgment. The two men, women grinding at the mill, the same. But it doesn't matter if you want to believe it the other way. It's okay. This doesn't have to be the context that it's referring to here. The issue is that we are to be ready. We are to know what that would look like to be ready. It's interesting to think of what ready is. What does it mean to have your house in order, your being in order, your mind in order? What is it like to be ready for God to come back? If you know God was coming back at 3 o'clock this afternoon, would you do anything different? Would there be anything that you would do? I mean, I don't know if he was just going to walk through your house, you know, and look at your stuff. Maybe you're, you know, perfect and fine and everything would be great, but maybe there's some things that you would kind of wade through and look at. Most of us older believers, we've really kind of given up on trying to clean ourselves up too much because it's just hopeless. You know, you're like, Lord, just be merciful, please. Because I can't make myself better. It just doesn't work. You know, we've never been able to change ourselves. God changes us slowly over a long period of time where we're conformed to his image. And maybe we've been able to help somebody or do some good. But often we don't. The comfort that we have is God is doing what God does. We can get upset about politics. We can get upset about crime. We can get upset about our wife or our husband or our kids or our parents. But we don't change ourselves very much and we don't change others very much. So the truth is we just need to be drawing close to God. Every day should be lived as close as you could possibly get to him with complete mindfulness of him. Francis Schaeffer, one of my favorite theologians, said, I don't know if he is able to do it all the time, but he said whenever he's asked a question, he tries to hesitate and ask the Lord for wisdom before he answers. Now, I don't know if women do this, but I know that men don't generally, because we already knew the complete answer before she even asked, so we could just give it, you know. I mean, we didn't even need to let her finish the question. As a matter of fact, we can just roll out there. And we're a veritable dispensing machine of wisdom, right? No, it's the thing is I've often asked that question, how far did we fall when we fell in the garden? You know, I mean, it was supposed to be pretty good. It was supposed to be really good. And we fell. We fell a long ways. When we consider, like I mentioned that guy from 1600s in England, you know. In one breath, he's very pious and begging God to forgive him. And in the next breath, he's killing somebody in jail for not believing that he has the authority that he thinks he has. Now, I don't think many of us have power over life and death, literally. But in one way, we can. We can hurt people. We can have collateral damage to our actions, our choices that affect people for years. So if we walk humbly with God, doesn't that make it a little bit better? He's just asking us here in these verses, no matter how you interpret them, be ready, be mindful of me in all things, so that when I come back, there's no shock for you. It shouldn't matter whether God's coming back today or 5 years from now. Your behavior should be exactly the same. If he wanted it to be different, he'd have given us the date and made us squeeze our behavior in right at the last minute, right? Lord, I hope I didn't forget to confess one sin here or I'm doomed, right? But we know we have to fall a lot more on God's grace and mercy than that. If we forget one sin and we're doomed, guess what? We're doomed. God is very good to us. These are hard times for the disciples, really difficult times, really challenging times. Their whole mind is just completely being turned upside down about all their religious beliefs. We see that down through the ages. We see that through Martin Luther. Didn't that happen to him? His whole thing was turned upside down. Each Reformation was another critical turn. The Puritans fleeing, you know, they weren't so pure. I'm not quite sure where they got that word, but, you know, those guys always trying to plea. We're always trying to do that, move closer to God. But if we can do it in just a simple, pleasant humbleness before him, we sure make our faith a lot more appealing to those rather than a harsh, legalistic, arrogant faith that pretends like we know so much more than we really do. Let's pray. God, you are really good to us, really, really good to us, and we are so thankful for that. We see very darkly, very dimly, and but we don't want that that dimness to offend you and to cause others to stumble. So continue to move us toward what you'd have us to do, be and act and to know you so that we can draw as close as we possibly can and give you the proper place in our life that you created us to enjoy. Thank you again for incredible grace and mercy extended as a righteous act on your behalf toward us. In Jesus' name, amen.